Stephen Jenness is a clinician and a researcher involved in many areas of medical science. Initially, he was involved in obstetrics and gynecology, as well as environmental medicine, has authored over 80 publications in all the prestigious medical journals in the English-speaking world. He's also served as the women's healthcare physician for an inner-city clinic, tells you something about his own ethical commitments, and has been awarded the commemorative medal from the Governor General in recognition of his significant contribution to Canada. He's also been Teacher of the Year and plays the piano, and I trust he's going to do that for us tonight and at least sing a part of his lecture. I also understand, although I haven't explored it, that he is part of a group called the Dixie Docks. And we won't be inquiring about that. Until after, maybe.
Are they connected to the Dixie Chicks?
I expect they're maybe relatives. So I'm delighted you're here. Thank you for coming and leading us in rethinking healthcare.
I was just saying thanks to them and thanks to Pastor Ingrid. I'm not used to speaking in churches. I'm used to speaking in sort of academic facilities. When I was a little boy, I think my mother wanted me to be a priest. And so speaking in a church is about as close as I'll get, I guess. So this evening, I look forward to sharing with you some ideas with regards to healthcare. And I look forward to your feedback, and we'll go from there. Go back to the next slide. The Canadian healthcare system has been a source of national pride in this country, and Canada has been described as a nation that cares for its people. The greatest Canadian was the father of Medicare, and our healthcare system has been based on compassion, and it's been discussed as a healthcare is provided by need, not on your ability to pay. Now, most Canadians, me included, are passionately want to preserve our healthcare system. And as you know, healthcare has been often the foremost issue in most federal and many provincial elections. There has been a lot of concern lately because there have been some groups that appear to want to deconstruct our current model of healthcare. And so some people have been concerned about this. But I want to talk about a problem that I think is really eroding healthcare that most people are not aware of and that I believe needs to be addressed. But many people, even those within the healthcare system, are often not aware of this. And so I'd like to bring some attention to it tonight. So I want to talk about the problem, and then I want to talk about the origins of the problem, and then moving forward. Now, it was described by the Canadian Public Health Agency, by the Government of Canada, a few years ago, and that they summarized it, and I'm just going to read their quote, that the burden of preventable death and disease has been growing, reducing the quality of life, increasing wait times for healthcare, and challenging the sustainability of the healthcare system. And now increasing evidence is showing that chronic care institutions are increasingly being inhabited by younger and younger residents. In the medical literature, The Lancet is one of the leading medical journals in the world. And the editor of The Lancet, Dr. Horton, talks about the neglected epidemic of chronic disease. If you look in Canada, about 80% of our health care is devoted to chronic disease. About 72% in the world globally, but in Canada, about 80% of the healthcare. And in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the second leading medical journal in the world, when they're discussing the increase in chronic conditions, they indicate that the health and social welfare systems are unprepared for the rapid growth in demands that will arise from these epidemics. So the challenge I want to talk about is though, although we have unprecedented success in medicine at addressing acute problems, trauma, cardiac events, infectious disease, neonatal care. We have overall declining health of the population due to an epidemic of chronic illness. Now, this is counterintuitive to many people. And they say, well, what do you mean we have declining health? We have increased life expectancy. And so many interventions that we have for people today. But let me talk about this misconception about life expectancy. The huge increase in life expectancy that we've enjoyed over the last number of decades has been primarily due to improved infant survival. If you look at the way that life expectancy is determined, essentially they add up where people die, and they divide by the number of people, and they come up with an average. So, for example, if a person dies at 90 and another one at 80, they would total them at 170, divided by 2, and the life expectancy would be there 85 years. But if you take someone who dies at 90, and then a neonatal death, where a child dies shortly after birth, then it's 90 divided by 2, and the life expectancy is 45. And so the dramatic increase in life expectancy is because there's been a profound decline. If we look from, for example, from 1940 to 2006, there's been a close to 90% decline in the infant mortality. And so when you remove all those deaths that occur in the first year of life, the life expectancy automatically is going to go up. It's a statistical calculation. In fact, if you really want to look at the life expectancy, the thing to do is to look at the life expectancy at age 60, right? And if we look at the figures in this country, for example, since 1951 to 2011, over the last 60 years, for both men and women, the increase in life expectancy has only been 5 years. And that's primarily due to major advances in acute care, trauma, cardiac events, our ways of managing infectious disease, right? So contemporary medicine is incredible at managing acute illness, but the challenge lies with managing chronic disease. And if, you know, what am I talking about? Well, it goes through the spectrum of illnesses. For example, if we look in age groups, the incidence of Alzheimer's has been increasing dramatically, and in younger people, so that representatives of their community talk about that it's growing at an epidemic pace and that the skyrocketing financial and personal costs will devastate the world's economies and healthcare systems. Okay. But if we look at the other end of the spectrum, for children, we see a dramatic increase in chronic illness in children as well. For example, at a recent conference in Ottawa, at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario, they talked about the tenfold increase in inflammatory bowel disease in children. If we look at the genders, gynecologic problems in women have increased dramatically over the last number of years. But if we look at men, illnesses specific to them, such as prostate cancer, we've seen a marked incline as well. If we look at different kinds of afflictions, all sorts of afflictions are increasing. If we look at chronic pain, it's going up dramatically in younger people. There are long waiting lists for pain clinics. And one of the areas that's really taken off is the rate of mental illness. When I graduated from medical school in 1979, I was taught that mental illness will afflict about 1 in 20 people. But the current rates that people are talking about now are about 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 people will develop a serious mental illness in their life. And I just received the Maclean's magazine today at our home, and they're talking about the broken generation. A shocking number of Canadian students feel depressed, even suicidal. Right? We're seeing profound rates of mental illness in younger and younger people. And if we look at depression, for example, the common cold of mental illness, it has gone up so profoundly. And one of my patients who's involved in public health is involved in immunization clinics. And she told me that when the people come to their clinic for an immunization, They ask a little bit about their medical history and what medications that they're on. And she told me at the last clinic that she ran, just people coming in for vaccinations, she said that 37% of them were on some sort of psychotropic medication. So this is not the exception. We're seeing so many people on chronic psychiatric medication. If we look at cancer, there has been a dramatic increase. If we look at the lifetime cancer rates, it's increased so profoundly. But the United Nations came out with a World Cancer Report, and they talk about a significant increase in cancer in the young as well as the old, and that they anticipate a 50% increase in rates of cancer over the next two decades. And again, people think, well, maybe this is because of an aging population. They talked about 15 to 29-year-old females, how it's going up every year in Canada. And if we look at breast cancer, a recent publication in the Lancet, they looked at between 1980 and 2010, the number of women diagnosed with breast cancer has increased by more than 2.5 times. Right? Now, when you present this information to people, people are often suspicious in the medical community because it's foreign to what they're used to thinking, that we've made such great strides with regards to illness. And there's two things that typically, well, first thing, they often bring up the life expectancy thing. We've already addressed that. The second thing, though, is say, well, these rises are to be expected in an aging population, which we have, and also that these figures may be an artifact. So let's look at that, okay? Published in the Journal of the American Medical Association recently, the number of children and youth in the United States with chronic health conditions has increased dramatically over the last four decades. So it's not just our seniors. If we look at rates of asthma and allergies and obesity, diabetes, hypertension, psychiatric afflictions, on and on and on, they're going up in our young people. For example, a few weeks ago, there was a publication in a journal called Hypertension where they talk about blood pressure in children going up in an alarming rate. This one is really concerning. Autism, which is a chronic neuropsychiatric children that has illness that has profound implications long-term for children. In 1985, not so long ago, it was a relatively rare condition at 1 in 2,500, and it's seeing a steady rise such that the recent figures 3 years ago in the UK, about 1 in 64 children, an escalation of over 3,500% over the last 35 years. And if you look at some areas in some communities, for example, in Minnesota, the rates in 2011 of 1 in 56 children, but in a particular community, in the Somali community, 1 in 28 children, so one child per classroom, with no sign that this trend is going to abate anytime soon. Right? Now, some people say, well, that's just because we're diagnosing autistic children more these days. And that may be true, so that may account for a 10 or a 20% increase. It doesn't account for a 3,500% increase. And in fact, a recent publication in a journal called Epidemiology exactly looked at that, and they claim that only a small portion of increased autism rates can be accounted for by those factors. We're seeing a dramatic rise in this serious illness. Okay. Now, the second thing that some people claim is that it's because, you know, we're diagnosing these things earlier and so on. But let me say that the study of epidemiology is credible science where they're comparing apples to apples. The way that diabetes is defined, you know, is relatively the same. I mean, declining sperm counts haven't changed in the last 30 years in the sense of the way that they're defined. You know, so if we look at many illnesses, this is not just an artifact because of numbers. The figures are going up dramatically. Just one example. Today in the newspaper I saw, and that's why I used this slide. Soaring demand forces busy fertility clinic to expand. Okay? So many young people are struggling to have children. In 1984, the rate in Canada was about 5% of couples 18 to 29, and it's almost triple in 2000. And 10. So this is all kinds of afflictions we're seeing going. Diabetes, another one. You know, when Sir William Osler wrote his foundational book on principles and practices of medicine, diabetes at that time was 2 in 100,000. Now it's 9% of the population and rising fast. Okay. Now, so the problem that we have here is that we have an increasing number of people, both young and old, seriously impaired by ill health. And the increase in life expectancy that we do have, with people living longer but getting sick earlier, simply means that they're spending a greater percentage of their lives sick with chronic illness. Okay. So the astonishing thing is, though, is that this is at a time where we have unprecedented resources devoted to medical research, to medical care, to things like cancer research. How many, marathons and telethons and run for the cures, how much money has been devoted? Yet we're not seeing a decline, we're seeing an increase. Now, what's the impact on the healthcare system? Well, of course, it's been profound. I'm trying to be nonpartisan. If we look at the rise in expenditures with regards to illness, in 1975, the total Canadian expenditure was $12 billion, and you see the rate of rise, with no evidence that this is declining, up to over $200 billion in 2011. Right? And the per capita in 1975 was $527, and now it's over $5,600. Right? There's no sign of it slowing, and that's why people are saying this is unsustainable. It's the biggest expenditure for each province, approaching 50% in some areas, well ahead of inflation and population growth. And the reality, though, is that many people are very dissatisfied with the outcomes, and so they're turning to other kinds of medicine that isn't even funded by healthcare, because of desperation, looking for help with their chronic affliction. And we see that there are now way more visits to complementary and alternative health providers than there are to primary physicians. So, the emerging evidence. We have declining individual and public health. The public healthcare systems cannot sustain the escalating demand for these services. In the current system, if nothing is done, will likely continue to erode. But most people are not aware of this reality, and some refuse to believe. The question is why? Why do we have so many sick people, and what is causing all this chronic illness? And in order to address that question, it's important to step back a little bit and to ask the question, if we have so many sick people, why do people get sick in the first place? Like, what is it that causes illness? Okay. What I'd like to do is I'd like to spend a few minutes just looking at history. The father of scientific medicine is a fellow named Hippocrates, and he lived around 400 BC. And at that time when he worked, conventional wisdom was that illness is caused by spirits, by metaphysical factors. And for example, they thought that pain was caused by the Greek god Apollo shooting arrows. And so the way that illness was managed, and this was sort of cutting-edge medicine at that time, is that people would take potions that would be given to them by physicians to appease the spirits. But Hippocrates observed a number of things, and one of them was that potions were often being used by medical practitioners who were being bribed by business and political rivals to cause harm to people. And Hippocrates, one of my heroes, responded. And this picture, and it's a little bit hard to see, this painting is incredible. It is him refusing to take a bribe, refusing to do harm to anyone. And he crafted what most people here would know as the Hippocratic Oath, as a template for ethical practice in medicine, where it says that I will use treatment to help the sick according to my ability and judgment, but never with the view to injury and doing wrong. And this became the principal code of conduct for physicians for over two millennia, and it was recently discarded. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we do the other talk on discrimination on the basis of ethical orientation. So I'm going to leave the ethical aspect for a couple of weeks to the next talk. But Hippocrates, and a lot of people aren't aware of this, as well as writing the Hippocratic Oath, was involved in a much broader document that the Hippocratic Oath was only one small part of, called the Hippocratic Corpus. Hippocrates observed a few things. He noticed that there was diversity depending on birth. He noticed that there must be inherited diversity because the way the children were born had a lot to do in terms of their outcomes. And so he was concerned about some sort of inherited factor. He also noted that the way that people ate had a profound difference on their health. And the different areas of Greece where he lived, that there appeared to be different rates of illness. So there was the concern about environmental contributors. And of course, he noted that when people were given poisons, that toxins could cause illness. So Hippocrates rejected this paranormal causation of illness. And he wrote this collection of works. And what he surmised, to put it briefly, is this unconventional, alternative idea that every disease has a natural cause. And he surmised that if you find the cause, then you can cure the disease, right? Now, this was very weird thinking back then, but for this, in his writings, he became given the title the father of scientific medicine, right? He took medicine from a religion to a science. But despite Hippocrates' teaching, there was the ongoing pervasive idea that illness was related to the supernatural. And it continued this way till the Middle Ages, around the time of 1500. And we see that, for example, this pervasive idea that, for example, demonic possession was an explanation of aberrant behavior, and there was lots of tragedies occurred at that time. But around 1500, there was a fellow named Philippus von Hohenheim, who is now referred to as the father of modern toxicology. Now, he was an alchemist and a physician and an astrologer, and he was the one that hypothesized that maybe illness is related to a chemical imbalance. Okay? Now, how did he come to this conclusion? Well, his sort of classic writing was a book called On the Minor Sickness and Other Diseases of Miners. And he documented occupational risks associated with metal working. And so he recognized that adverse exposures, like Hippocrates had a number of years before, that adverse exposures caused illness. And so what he thought is he wondered whether he could correct the chemical imbalance. And so he started using chemicals in small doses to try to treat people who were afflicted as a result of exposures. So we started using things like mercury and lead and arsenic, okay? And so this became a common practice. And so, I mean, just for example, if we look at George Washington many years later, he had a sore throat and fever one day, and they tried treating him with a phlebotomy where they took blood. He didn't respond, so the next day they treated him with mercury, right? And he died, okay? So, but we see the first then factor in terms of what causes illness. Adverse exposures cause illness. The second cause that was identified in history relates to a fellow named James Lind. And his story is interesting because he was working in the Navy at a time when scurvy was very, very prevalent. And many people on the boats would die of scurvy, and nobody could figure out why this was happening. And Lynn wondered whether it was related to diet. So he did a controlled trial in his boat, and he took a number of people and broke them into groups and used different things. And one of the groups, he gave two oranges and an 11 to, and they were better within a week. So what he did is he did this crossover trial. He took the oranges and lemons from them, gave them to the next group. First group got sick, second group got better. And he realized that there was something in those oranges and lemons that was causing illness. And of course, it's related to vitamin C that's in the citrus fruit, but they weren't aware of that back then. The thing is, though, is he tried to tell his superiors, but they rejected him and told him it was foolhardy. And nobody on Lynn's ships ever died from scurvy, but it took more than four decades before they would accept his ideas and adopt it. So here is the introduction of the translation of knowledge in medicine, right? When new information comes out, no matter how compelling the evidence, it usually takes one to two generations before it is adopted on the streets. And like my friends, that hasn't changed, as we'll get into in a minute, okay? Now, just before that, I was going to say, the British Navy, though, oranges were too expensive, so they used limes instead, and that's why the Brits are sometimes referred to as limeys. Okay, so next slide. The third major contribution with regards to causation of illness was found at the hands of an Augustinian priest named Gregor Mendel. And Mendel was doing research with plants and found that there appeared to be logical transmission of traits from one generation to the next. And so he reported on this. In fact, he was called, once again, his ideas were rejected. He was called a monster. But subsequent work done on people showed the same thing. And so he is given the title of the father of genetics, and that genetics appear to be involved in the transmission of predisposition to illness. So, number three, genetics are involved. So we have adverse exposures, deficiencies of nutrients, and genetics. Next slide. The next one I have a particular interest in, as I worked as an obstetrician for many years, and this is a fellow named Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis, and his story is fascinating. This was a fellow who worked in Europe at a time when the postpartum mortality rate, in other words, when a woman went in to have a baby, she had about a 20 to 25% chance of dying associated with that birth process. And so we don't hear about women dying in childbirth very much anymore, but it used to be a everyday event. And so what happened was that he was a thinker and a critical thinker, and he noticed a few things. The prostitutes who delivered on the streets, who weren't allowed into the hospitals, they didn't have prenatal care. They're the more high-risk population. Their rate of death was, you know, it was only like, you know, 3% or so, okay? Dramatically different than the 20% that was happening. So he said, something's got to be happening in hospital. And one of the other things he noticed is that when the medical students went on holidays and the women were delivered by midwives, the mortality rate plunged. So, he said, it's got something to do in the hospital, and it's got something to do with the medical students. So, to make a long story short, he looked at what are the medical students doing that are different than the midwives, and identified a few things, tried to interrupt them, and one of the things he found was the medical students were, you know, dissecting cadavers in the anatomy lab, and then they would go to the case room. So he wondered, I wonder if they're carrying something. So he started a hand-washing technique, and overnight, puerperal fever, as it was called, dropped from 20, you know, down to about 1%, right? And so he was so excited because he had discovered the cause of puerperal fever. But I must tell you that he was ostracized and mocked. I mean, a simple technique, just people could just try it, wash your hands. He had math training, he prepared stats, but he was rejected in the medical community. And it was only when his students came through, again, one to two generations, that he became a hero in medicine. So what do we find here? That some transmissible agent is a cause of disease. And this was furthered by Pasteur, who's the father of the germ theory, who found evidence of germs when there was open fractures and in surgery that were leading to death. And so number four, germs cause illness. Now, the last thing in medical history that is shown causes disease is the whole psychosomatic etiology. Freud and other people, particularly in the 19th century, recognized that psychological factors could impact health, and various psychological states could contribute to illness. And so this was the fifth and final causative factor involved in the source of disease. So what do we have? Toxic exposures, deficiencies, germs, genetics, and psychological factors. And that represents the accumulated wisdom since Hippocrates' time until now about the etiology of disease. Right? Now, there have been a lot of other notable heroes in medical history. For example, one fellow is a guy named Christian Eichmann, who won the Nobel Prize in 1929. And what happened there was that in the Orient, when European settlers came over, there was a very high rate of death from a disease called beriberi. But it wasn't happening in the native peoples. And so he was asked to come and figure out what's going on. And at the time, the paradigm was that illness is caused by germs. So he was looking for what germ could be causing illness in these settlers, but not in the native people. But when he got over there and was exploring, what he found is that the animals of people who were dying of this beriberi illness often would die and would show similar traits. And he thought, there's got to be something. There's got to be something going on. What could be going to the animals? And to make a long story short, he found that the settlers would not eat the brown rice that the native people had, that they would eat polished white rice, but the polished white rice would remove a particular vitamin called thiamine or vitamin B1 because it was in the outer coat of the rice. And so they became deficient in this nutrient. Okay, and so that was the beginning of the discovery of vitamins. But once again, it's a variation on a theme of deficiency. So many other heroes, but these were the five causative agents. Okay, so the question to bring us back to the current is, what do we think causes most contemporary illness now? Like, what's the paradigm now? What do we think causes illness? Well, let's look at the way that people are managed when they go to a health center. Commonly to a health provider, not all health providers, but the common algorithm is the patient comes in with their chronic illness and the patient gets assessed. They then assign something called a diagnosis. What does that mean, a diagnosis? A diagnosis is simply a label. It's a convenient label that we use to communicate, you know, from one medical person to another what's going on. For example, osteoporosis. Osteo is the Greek word for bone. Porosis is the Greek word for holes. So it means, in Greek, bones with holes in them. But osteoporosis sounds a lot sexier than does, you know, bones with holes in them, right? But people think when they have a diagnosis that it's some special thing. It doesn't tell you at all what's causing the problem. It simply describes what they have. So when they say that you have clinical depression, what does it mean? You're depressed, right? So we assess the patient, we give them a label, okay, and then we plug in the medications or surgery if the medications are unsuccessful. And then many of these people then spend the rest of their life coping with their chronic illness. Okay? Let's look at examples. Depression. Somebody comes in, they're given a diagnosis of depression after assessing them, and then they're often put on antidepressants, and then they stay on the antidepressants, right? Okay. I like this painting by Vincent van Gogh at Eternity's Gate. He took his own life, sadly. The man suffered profoundly from depression. We'll talk a little bit about more about him in just a couple of minutes. Okay. Let's look at women with heavy irregular menstrual periods, such a common problem among women these days. Okay, unlike what Jesus did, where somebody touched his robe and healed, most physicians don't have that ability. And so when people come in, they get assessed for this, they get given a diagnosis. Often medications and hormones are tried to control the problem. And if that's unsuccessful, then they end up with surgery. Okay. The astonishing thing is, though, is that the cause of what's causing the bleeding or their depression or their Crohn's disease or their osteoarthritis or their autoimmune disease or their cancer or whatever it is often ignored in the algorithm for managing patients. And, you know, one would ask, well, why is that? If there was a correctable causation, certainly one would explore and treat the cause to resolve the problem. I mean, that would seem to be basic science, right? But there is a fundamental assumption in this algorithm that is being used these days for medical care, in that we live in a paradigm of genetic predestination, right? In that the cause of chronic diagnosis is assumed inexplicable, and it's assumed to be genetic and to be non-correctable. Okay? So if we look at this in the framework of what medicine has showed us throughout history, the main belief about the cause of chronic disease now is genetics. Yes, people will say we have some illnesses like HIV, okay, and some other chronic infections. Hepatitis, for example, can be related to germs. Yes, we do adopt that. Psychological factors, yes, may be impacting. But primarily people with chronic disease, the assumption is the source is genetic. The whole area of nutritional deficiency and toxicity has been left behind. Okay? And so we have this predestinational model where we assume that people have a genetic predisposition. You got a chronic illness, it's likely because you had the wrong parents, you know, and that you're just this hapless victim of some cosmic genetic roulette kind of thing, right? And so you're ill, and we treat you with drugs and surgery, and so it implies acceptance of your diagnosis then as destiny, right? Now, the question is why have these two fundamental causative factors been left behind? Why are they not taught in medical school? Okay? Well, let me tell you that it's been assumed that in the Western world, where we have, for most people, an abundance of food, right, that people are getting all that they need from their foods. So deficiencies must not be a common cause of illness. So why would we spend valuable time in medical school training and teaching about dietary deficiencies when it's not a common cause of illness here? And so that has been left behind. The second has been, well, toxins. Well, you know, people aren't being poisoned all over the place. Yes, maybe perhaps, you know, the occasional person who's been involved in some explosion or something like that. But it's not a common cause of illness. So yes, we'll have some specialists in that area, but it's not a common thing. So these two areas have been left behind. But there have been now a lot of fundamental challenges over the last few years to this whole genetic paradigm. And we are on the cusp of change. Okay? Fundamental questions. If the cause of most illness is inherited, why do so many identical twins who've got the same genome have completely different health outcomes? Right? Next slide. Just a couple of examples. A few months ago, a study was released on Parkinson's where they looked at identical twins, 49 pairs of identical twins, where one had Parkinson's and the other one didn't. If it was genetic predestination and they have the same genomes, they should have the same outcomes, and they didn't. Next slide. Another study that just came out a few weeks ago looking at autoimmune disease. Same thing, looking at identical twins, often completely different health outcomes. There's got to be something more than genetics. Right? The next thing is, why do so many people have chronic afflictions that nobody in their ancestry has? I mean, if it's supposed to be inherited genetically, who did you inherit it from if nobody in your ancestry has this? Right? Another question. Our genes haven't changed over the last 35 years since this autism explosion has occurred. So what's going on? There's got to be something other than genetics. Right? Another thing, when people migrate from one area of the world to another and they adopt the new patterns and lifestyles of the new area, for example, if you take Japanese people where the incidence of chronic illness is much, much, much lower and they have longer life expectancy, when they come to the West, you know, their rates if they adopt our lifestyle increases dramatically and parallels ours. Okay, their genes aren't changing on the boat over, right? Okay, so the reality is that the scientific world has begun to realize that this predestinational illness paradigm is misguided. It's wrong, okay? And there must be other factors along with genetics that are contributing to health and illness. The question is, what might they be? Okay, now, in the last 10 to 20 years, there has been a lot of study in this whole area of something called molecular medicine. And there are subfields like epigenetics and genomics and environmental medicine, a lot of biophysics going on. And basically the story is they're endeavoring to gain insights into the genetic and cellular basis of disease by studying factors that are influencing cell function. And the findings have been incredible. And it recently led the Center for Disease Control, a major international health body, to state that virtually all disease, not occasional disease, but virtually all human disease results from the interaction of the fixed genome and the modifiable environmental factors. Okay? So, next slide. So that this predestinational model of genes causing disease is wrong. Next slide. And that, in fact, this appears to be the true model of why people get sick. That yes, it's a predispositional model, in that our genes may predispose us. We are all unique from a genetic makeup point of view, but there are things in our environment that interact with our genes to determine our health, which is exciting because it means we're not these hapless victims, right? That there are things in our environment that are modifiable. In other words, that we choose, potentially, that can be changed, that we can intervene with if we recognize that will have a profound difference to our health. Now, one of the really exciting areas is called epigenetics, which means upon our genes. And it's being found that it's the study of factors that control our genes, that control genetic expression, okay? And that regulate, turn our genes on, turn them off, and so on, okay? And just one example that was published in a journal called Nature Reviews, and they're looking at therapy of cancer from an epigenetic point of view. And they say that the initiation of progression of cancer is controlled by both genetic and epigenetic events. But unlike genetic alterations, which you can't change, you're born with them, your predisposition, which are almost impossible to reverse, the epigenetic aberrations are potentially reversible, allowing the malignant population to revert to a more normal state. That's groundbreaking, right? It means that you can turn cancer back to get it to revert if you alter the epigenetic environment, okay? Great information, and so hopeful, okay? And the guys that won the Nobel Prize in 2006 were people that were working on mechanisms that regulate gene expression. So, we now have a new paradigm, an idea where genetics may load the gun, but unless the trigger is pulled, there's no issue. It's the environmental factors that are pulling the trigger, okay? So the next question is, what are the environmental factors? Go to the next. There is a new term that's now been introduced in the scientific literature that is called the exposome. And the exposome refers to that totality of environmental factors that are interacting with our genes to determine health and illness. Okay? So this word is, I think, a great term to be used. But if we look at what those factors are, let's just step back for a minute. Let's look at any functional system, okay? Whether it's your car, your dog, your plant, or yourself. If you look at any functional system, in order to thrive, there are certain things you need. So to thrive, you have to get what you need, and you have to stay away from things that are harmful, right? Your plant needs water, it needs sunlight, okay? And it needs nutrients, and you have to keep it away from things like Roundup and stuff like that, right? So giving it the things that it needs and keeping it away. So any functional system is like that. And although it sounds simplistic, we're the same. In order to be well, we have to get this exposome is completely made up of are we getting the things that we need and are we away from those things that are harmful to us. Okay. But what's being found, interestingly, is that there appear to be common factors involved in many or most of the disease processes that we have now. And there's an expanding body of scientific research in the areas that's very intricate, in areas of genomics and epigenetics and molecular medicine. and they're finding that deficiency states and toxicity states are what are leading to the widespread epidemic of illness that we have. Cell deficiencies and toxicities, right? So if we look at the paradigm then, it's our fixed genome interacting with our environment, and that environment is only made up of two things. Are we getting what we need, and are there things that are harmful to us, right? But you know what? This isn't new at all. It's not new at all, right? It's what's been the accumulated wisdom of medical history, but it's what has been recently left behind in medical education, right? Which is the whole issue of deficiency and toxicity. Okay? And all kinds, I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. All kinds of diseases now are associated with deficiency states. Let me give you just one example. If you want more, we can discuss it afterwards, but I'll just give you one. Here's a vitamin. Just like vitamin B1 was required and was deficiency was causing beriberi all over the place in the Orient, right, that Eichmann discovered and won the Nobel Prize for, let's look at vitamin D now. Vitamin D is an essential hormone that's required for innumerable physiological processes within the body. It's a required nutrient, okay? And recent publication in 2010 found it's involved, it has binding sites on over 2,700 different genes. It's involved in all kinds of epigenetic regulation, right? Next slide. But numerous studies have showed that more than 70% of Canadians are deficient in this basic nutrient that we need, okay? And I was involved in a study in Edmonton, and we tested over 1,500 people, and we found that the average level of vitamin D is about half of what would be optimal, and we found that in this range, about 70% of people were deficient. Okay? And some are extremely deficient. Now, in the scientific literature, there is all kinds of papers looking at what's the outcome of deficiency of vitamin D. And there's all kinds of things, from gynecologic problems to chronic back pain. You think of how many people have chronic back pain, right? Okay, impaired bone health, osteoporosis, immune function, high blood pressure, and a whole slew of cancers. And I could go on and on and on, simply from the deficiency of vitamin D. Okay? Now, I'm just going to mention two studies from the mainstream scientific literature, okay? That in one of the studies, it was published a few years ago, they took postmenopausal women, they broke them, this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. In other words, they had a whole bunch of women. The doctors didn't know who was getting and who was getting the stuff and who wasn't, who was getting the placebo. The patients didn't know. They were either getting placebo or they were getting the vitamin D. Those who received the vitamin D, their risk of getting any kind of cancer, okay, dropped by 77%, close to 80%, just in those getting a vitamin D supplement in years 2 to 5 after taking it. Can you imagine using any kind of intervention that would, how incredible that would be? But this is published in the scientific literature. And I'm going to tell you another study, which I find particularly intriguing. And this is a study that was reported in The Lancet, right? So this isn't the National Enquirer. This is you know, one of the most widely read journals in the world. And this isn't a small study. They looked at over 25,000 participants. Now, some of you may know that there has been a big move with regards to doing screening on people for colorectal cancer because the incidence of this problem is going through the roof and it's killing a lot of people and it's causing a lot of suffering. So there's recommendations to physicians, you know, when people reach a certain age, you know, we need to test for stool to see if there's any sign of blood, and many people are now recommending regular colonoscopies where they put a long hose up your backside to see if there's any evidence of any sign as a screening method. Now, the objective of this is it doesn't prevent getting cancer. They just hope to pick it up early, because if they pick it up early, then they get it before it spreads, hopefully, to diminish the mortality. Now, the published objective of early detection is to reduce colorectal cancer mortality in those screened by 13 to 15% over the next 20 years. That's the objective published, okay, in the medical literature. But what this study in The Lancet did is they looked at over 25,000 people at their vitamin D levels. Those who had high good vitamin D levels and those who had low vitamin D levels. And they found that the risk of ever acquiring, catching it in the first place, colorectal cancer, dropped by 75 to 80% for those that had good vitamin D levels, right? I mean, it's remarkable. So if you want to talk in terms of healthcare saving, okay, you imagine the cost involved dealing with all the people with cancer. So this is just one example, okay? So the bottom line is, this doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand. If you're missing essential biochemicals that your body needs, your cells can't do what they're designed to do, and you'll get dysfunction, and that will cause illness, right? But many people have deficiencies. Now, you may say, well, how can people have deficiencies? You know, we've got so much stuff around us. People eat. So many people take supplements. But there has been an assumption that what you put in your mouth is what's getting into your cells. And it's being found that that just isn't so. What you put in your mouth has to be digested. It then has to be absorbed. Okay? It then has to be assimilated. It then has to be utilized. And only then you have the nutritional status. If there's anything that is interfering with these processes along the way, and there are various things, as we'll get into in a minute, people will then end up with nutritional deficiency. So it's not only what you eat, and more it's being found that we have many people in the population who are ill because of deficiency. Okay. So we talked a little bit about deficiency. I'm going to talk about the other half of the exposome equation, and that's toxicity. Okay. Now, this idea of toxicity, it isn't new. There's lots of history talking about it. And, you know, some famous people are well known. If we look at Beethoven, for example, like unbelievable musical genius who has brought so much joy and into the world with his wonderful music, the poor man struggled. He became deaf. He had bipolar illness. He did a lot of bizarre things. And people just assumed, oh, it's just, you know, one of those musicians living a musician lifestyle. He must have gotten syphilis and, you know, had neurosyphilis. But in fact, when they assessed his some bone and hair a few years ago, they didn't find any evidence of syphilis. But what they did find is higher levels of lead in his body, and that he was receiving lead as a treatment for some malady. You'll remember about Paracelsus introducing the lead paradigm, okay? And so that's what they found. So he was toxic. But one that I find particularly moving is Vincent van Gogh, right? Now, another incredible artist who was so gifted, and some of you will know that song, Starry, Starry Night, with regards to Vincent van Gogh. That's a painting, Starry Night. One of the things that van Gogh has in some of his paintings is he has this halo around the light objects. And it's kind of interesting because he used to nibble on his paint chips, right, that were loaded with lead. And often people who have lead poisoning, they often get inflammation in their eyes, and the way that they see light objects is with halos around them, right? And what happened with Van Gogh, it's very interesting. So he had this background of lead exposure, and the poor man did some bizarre things. You know, one time he cut his ear off and sent it to his girlfriend in an envelope, and sadly, he took his own life. But he had the lead poisoning, but on top of that, when he would be painting, some of the paints had a lot of different chemicals in them, and he would breathe them, and he would get acute exposures and then would really flare, and he would then be admitted to psychiatric facilities to be cared for. But usually after a short period of time, when his body had a chance to detoxify some of this, he would improve, and they would release him, until he painted again and got re-exposed. And then what happened is one time they admitted him and they brought his painting in with his paintwork in with him into the hospital so he could paint there, and he never left, okay? Because he was exposed then on an ongoing basis, okay? So, yeah, but is this just something historical? No. The Center for Disease Control in 2009, again, major international medical body, did analysis on Americans, young, old, different genders, and they found that most American adults and children have now accumulated potentially toxic chemicals. Because since the Second World War, we've had the release of close to 100,000 various chemicals into our environment that are being used all over the place that people are being exposed to all the time. Okay? And we are the first generation in history to have widespread chemical exposure, and most of these have been untested for human safety. And I will tell you that there is a lot of study going on. I've been involved in some government work. There's some stuff going on in the province here, and there's stuff going on in the Canadian government. There's a lot going on now where they're looking at chemical exposures. For example, you may have heard of bisphenol A from plastics, right? I must tell you that I delivered lots of children, and I would encourage my patients, please don't use plastic bottles because this stuff leaches in, and then your baby will be exposed to this hormonally active chemical, right? And so, but this is just one of hundreds of thousands of chemical exposures that people are getting all over the place in the world nowadays, okay? Now, people think, what chemicals, what are you talking about? Well, if we look at cigarette smoking, most people recognize the tragedy of cigarette smoking and all the illness that it causes, right? And there was a fellow named Norm Delarue at Toronto General in Ontario in 1947 who talked about the association between lung cancer and smoking. And there was a publication, I think, in British Medical Journal in 1954 looking at lung cancer and smoking. But let me tell you, it wasn't accepted. It was laughed at and ridiculed, and it wasn't until the 1980s, again, a couple of generations later, when, you know, there was lawsuits and so on, that it began to get accepted. But cigarette smoke, that's only one of a whole bunch of chemicals that people are exposed to now. Okay? And there are now many mainstream medical journals. For example, one is called Environmental Health Perspectives, one of the leading public health journals in the world that are completely devoted to looking at exposures now and what they're causing. So there is lots going on in the scientific literature with regards to this whole area. And, you know, we've known little bits of alcohol in pregnancy can cause fetal spectrum problems, right, for the life of that person. We know about the dangers and the profound impact, right? But women in pregnancy now are being exposed to all kinds of things. In fact, a recent study done by the American Red Cross in the United States took cord bloods at birth, where before the baby had a chance to do anything, they take the cord and they take some blood from the cord and they tested for a number of chemicals for a few hundred, and they found the average baby at birth had 287 industrial pollutants in its system. Where's that coming from? From the mom, right? So if alcohol can cause those kind of problems, what about all these other chemicals? And you begin to see about issues like autism and chronic disease in children in terms of the exposures that they've had. Now, some people say, well, you know, what are you talking about? You know, you'd have to drink sort of a bucket load of mercury before it would do anything, right? And this is a common misconception, right? If we look at exposures in our own body, these chemicals, in terms of our body working, it works in parts per billion, right? Like, if I wanted to get one teaspoon of estrogen, okay, from women, okay, just one teaspoon, I would have to drain the blood of 250,000 reproductive age women to get one teaspoon. So you can imagine how much estrogen is in one woman, pretty small amount, and how much is at each potential receptor site. So in parts per billion and in parts per million, our normal biochemistry has profound effect. If we are exposed to other chemicals, to foreign chemicals around us, in parts per billion and parts per million, and some of those chemicals our body is unable to unload, because now it's being recognized that there's many compounds that just accumulate in the body because we don't have the mechanisms to unload them well, so they can accumulate more and more and more. They can reach levels where they begin to interfere epigenetically with our DNA and to induce illness. Okay? Now, this is just one example of a study that was published, and this is looking at death in children from ages 1 to 15 in the UK. And a fellow named Knox published this in a major public health journal. And What he did is he looked at where the children that died from cancer, which is a increasing and very, very tragic problem for families, as you can imagine, and he correlated this with the birth address of the child. In other words, where was the mom during the pregnancy? Okay, and he found that in almost all cases of children dying, even 15 years later, it was related to where the mom was in close proximity to certain kinds of emissions from industry during the pregnancy. Astonishing information. So it's not only that you're born looking funny or something like that, or you have some obvious abnormality, but there are processes that have been instilled because of those exposures that will cause illness long term. And increasingly, there's now this discussion of fetal origins of adult disease. And they're finding that exposures during pregnancy are being related to chronic illness in some situations down the road. This is another one that's astonishing, but has profound, hopeful implications. What was done here is they looked at women who work with solvents during pregnancy. They're not drinking the solvents, right? They're just working with them, breathing them in the air. Maybe they get some on their hands. And they found that women who work with solvents, their children are 13 times more likely to have major cardiac, major reproductive, and major neurological abnormalities at birth. Now think about it. It's absolutely wonderful that at the U of A we have incredible people that are gifted, that can do cardiac transplants and that kind of work. But think about if we could just prevent them by educating women about exposures in pregnancy, prior to the pregnancy, so that they know to avoid certain things that are going to cause them harm. Okay? Now, I mean, how do these compounds cause health problems? This is would be a whole other lecture. But let me say, some of these compounds act like hormones. Okay, like the bisphenol A, it's an estrogenic hormone. We call it a xenoestrogen. It behaves like an estrogen. Some mimic the hormones, some bind receptors, so they block certain hormones. Okay, you know, they can do a number of things. Some act on the genes to alter genes. Some block absorption in the gut so nutrients can't get in. Okay. Some accumulate in the thyroid so that they can cause an autoimmune reaction against the thyroid. We've had an explosion in thyroid illness. Okay. And so these compounds can act in many, many different ways. Okay. So I must tell you, I have reviewed a number of applications for grants. There is a lot of exciting science going on in this area. So what's out there making us sick? Why do we have this problem with chronic illness? Because we have increasing numbers of people with deficiencies and escalating problems with toxicity in our culture, right? So if you want to maximize health, then, say you want people to be well, what do you do? Well, we can't change the genome. But clinically, as physicians then, we can look at this exposome. We can do testing. And we can ask, is this person getting everything that they need? And are there things that are harmful? Okay? So in clinical practice then, this can be applied. And this whole area is called environmental medicine. And that's the area that I'm privileged to be involved in. Okay? So environmental health sciences is the clinical application of molecular medicine, where we assess this exposome and address it. Okay? Now, the algorithm then that we use is a little bit different. We assess the patient, we assign a diagnosis, because that's a convenient thing to use as a handle, but then we look for the cause of the diagnosis and treat the cause and intervene accordingly there. That's the approach that we take. A fundamentally different algorithm based on identifying what's causing the illness. Okay? And so what does that look like? Okay? So I'll just talk about how I apply this. I see patients only by referral from other physicians who've assessed the patient. And I assess them. We do an extensive history on them. We examine them. And then we do a laboratory evaluations. And in the evaluations, we're looking to find, does this person have all that their body needs in order to function, right? And if they don't, we explore why, right? So we're looking to see, do they have what they need? We get the story from them. We do investigations. And we also then look for toxic agents that they may have accumulated in their body or that they may be exposed to. And although we're at the early stages in this unfolding field, okay, there are many situations where we can intervene to address the accumulated toxins and to address the deficiencies. And by addressing them, I must tell you that I'm very blessed to have seen scores of people who have, you know, been restored from chronic illnesses. Okay? Next slide. So I just want to conclude here just by giving, you know, just some examples to put a face to how this applies. And once again, this is not new medicine. This is old medicine, just recognizing the accumulated wisdom of medical history. So this is a man who came to see me with disabling rheumatoid arthritis. He's 54 years old. He's been on 10-year history, and he has been increasingly disabled with pain and was given a poor prognosis. So he has this chronic illness. He's having a hard time functioning. He's on two drugs that are causing him significant problems. He's now getting liver damage associated with this chemotherapeutic drug called methotrexate. He's developing eye problems as a result of the other drug, but he needs them just in order to do any kind of function. He's unable to function without them. But when we did the initial investigations, I found that he was severely deficient in vitamin D. Why? Because vitamin D normally comes from the sun, acting on the on your skin, and it acts on the cholesterol of your skin to manufacture vitamin D, which then gets absorbed, and then it does its thing with your genes to help you. But this man worked in Fort McMurray. He slept during the days, and he worked at night, and so he didn't get any sunlight. His vitamin D was in the basement, and so he was low. So we corrected that. He was also deficient on a certain kind of essential fat called docosahexaenoic acid, which is involved in many other things and a very common deficiency. So what I did is, when I got his lab results back, I was very excited. I called him in, and I said, look, you're really deficient on this. He was going, like, he would come back and forth to Fort McMurray to see me. He was going to be up there for a six-week stint. I said, look, you know, start taking these right away. You need to be repleted. We'll get into this more when you get back and I get the results of your test. He came back 6 weeks later, sort of sheepishly, and he said, I'm off all my medications. My pain's all gone. I feel fine. So this man's deficiency in chronic illness was related to the fact that he was missing sufficient vitamin D and DHA. Okay, and so it's made a huge difference. Okay, the second one is also one that brought me lots of joy. And it was a man who was brought to me by his daughter, who is a nurse. And the man is 62 years old, and he had a 33-year history of bipolar illness. And he suffered a lot. And now he had progressive dementia so that he was unable to communicate and interact, and it was recommended that he would be put into a chronic care institution, and that that was all that could be done, and the family had to accept it. And so they wondered if there was anything that, you know, I might be able to do, and I wasn't sure, I didn't know, but we decided to do all that we could to try to address this. And so we did some investigations. And on the history that his wife gave me, as I have a book that they fill out, this man came from Holland. And when he came to Canada, he was working in a room making stained glass windows, right? And when you heat up the rims, there's lead in the windows, and he was breathing this stuff in constantly. And when we did his lead level, we found that it was through the roof. So once again, I was very excited about this, and I wondered, if we get the lead out, right, what will happen? Will he improve, right? So it is kind of an interesting story because the family was cautiously excited about finding, you know, this finding, but it made sense. He had this exposure. He was breathing this stuff in, smelling it. You smell it, it goes right through what's called the Krugerform plate, right into the brain. He's had this for a long time, you know, and he suffered a lot as a result, and we know that lead is accumulation in the brain is associated with various psychiatric problems. So what we did is we started interventions. But I will tell you that people think you can just do a blood test for lead. So what happened is that the family went to the psychiatrist and said, you know, this doc, you know, found lead in him, and he said, oh, you know, that's absolutely ridiculous. What kind of quack are you seeing? And the so he said, I'll show you. I'll do a blood test and a urine test for lead. So he did a blood and a urine test for lead, and it came back that they couldn't find any lead, right? And so, you know, the startle, and he said, see, but the toxicokinetics of lead, in other words, lead doesn't stay in the blood. When people get chemical exposures, the body does all that it can to protect itself. That's the way we were designed. So the body, in an effort to protect itself, shifts toxic chemicals into the cells. It sort of like puts them in the closet to get them away from the blood where it's most potent. So the way that we do the testing is you have to move it out of the cells with certain interventions and then bind it and get it out in the urine. So it was through this specialized testing that we found that he was loaded with lead. So over the next few months, we did the interventions to get the lead out of him, things that bind it and remove it. And I'll never forget the day he came into my office about 6 months, and he was slowly improving, and he joked around, and he began to interact, and now he's doing very well, and he's off his medications, and it's been thrilling for me. Okay? The last one I'll mention is a child with autism. And I will tell you that there are many things that appear to be causing autism. But I'm involved with a couple of researchers in the States, and we're writing a paper at the moment on the cause of autism, and a lot of it appears to be related to toxicant exposures during pregnancy and early life where the child is accumulating them in the brain. But in this situation, I saw a five-year-old child. This little boy, his mom worked at the Cross Cancer Institute, and he had severe autistic spectrum disorder. But when the parents came, I didn't know if there was anything that we could do, but we did the testing, and I found that he was grossly deficient on a number of basic nutrients that the brain needs to function. And I thought, I wonder if the deficiency is what's causing the brain problem in the autism. So, try to figure out, well, why is this child so deficient? He was, you know, eating well. The mother had tried lots of supplements. They tried all kinds of things. So clearly, the stuff was going in, but it wasn't getting to where it needed. And so I wondered about malabsorption. To make a long story short, we did some testing and found that this child had a reaction to gluten. He was reacting to gluten, which is a compound found in wheat, rye, barley, spelt. It's found in certain grains that can trigger inflammation. So I surmised, I wonder if this young guy, he's eating the gluten every day, you know, with bread and pasta and stuff like that, that it's causing inflammation, so he's not digesting and absorbing properly, and thus he's missing what his brain needs to function. So what we did is we removed the gluten for him, and after a number of weeks, he completely recovered, okay, and he's done very well. I've had some contact with the parents, and he continues to do really well, okay? So the bottom line is that this approach is not just some theoretical abstract written in medical history. It's the reality of why we have a pandemic of chronic disease. And it's hopeful, because if interventions are used, a significant difference can be made for many, many people. This is my last slide. Is this alternative medicine? Okay. And I'm not going to talk at length about alternative medicine, but some people in mainstream will throw this out, oh, you're in alternative medicine, you're doing this weird kind of stuff, right? Same thing like with Hippocrates, when he was the founder of scientific medicine, his stuff was considered alternative too, right? Let me tell you that finding out why people get sick, it's fundamental basic science. There's nothing alternative. I mean, just imagine if you had a noise in your car, a knock in your engine, right? And you went to the mechanic, right? And you said, I've got a noise in my car. And so he said, come back at the end of the day. So you come back at the day, and he says to you, oh, yeah, I know what. You have gearitis, okay? Okay? And he said, you know, the latest treatment for that is, you know, I'll put a muffler in your panel so that you won't hear the noise anymore, right? You'd think, what's causing my gearitis? What's the cause? And, you know, that's pretty basic. And I think that our bodies are certainly as valuable as our cars. And when people get sick, I believe that we should be exploring the underlying cause of why people are getting sick and doing our utmost to reverse it. Now, so again, rethinking healthcare. I believe that the whole pandemic of chronic disease that is draining and eroding our healthcare system will continue to do so. And we can do all kinds of gyrations with economics. As you know, there have been all kinds of people that have come up with reports and tried this and tried that, okay? as long as we have increasing decline in the health of the population, I think we're going to be in trouble, and we have to look at why people are getting sick. Thank you so very much for listening. And
is there resistance to this within the profession? Are there vested interests that get in the way of this being pursued vigorously? I mean, you're somewhat unique in your work here.
Let me say that it's relatively new in the profession, though. So I don't know that most people have not had a chance to be apprised of the information. So I don't know that there is resistance. It just most people haven't heard of it because in their training, they haven't heard about it and they haven't had an opportunity. So I haven't met with a lot of resistance. And I will say that when I've had the privilege of speaking to medical students, you know, they're very critical thinkers. And, you know, if there's holes in what I'm presenting, they'll push holes. And thus far, I've had nothing but sort of, you know, interest and keen excitement. But it's new information. And if we look at history, new information takes a long time to filter down.
I remember thinking when the Surgeon General's report came out in the United States, I was living in Chicago, about smoking. And there was some discussion at the time about this, this whole issue of smoking being the cause of so much chronic disease. But the pushback was, yeah, you've decided that it's smoking, so we can ignore all the industrial pollutants. What you're pointing out is we need to look at this. I mean, the chemical load is coming from a variety of places.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Please, if you want to raise issues, speak to some of these matters, query.
So yes, I just have a really simple question. You were talking about vitamin D going through your skin, which I understand.
Right.
But most of us do not work in outside anymore.
Right.
And if we do, we're covering up with sunscreens. So do you recommend vitamin D by supplement, and if so, how much?
Okay. Thank you. First of all, let me say that I'm not one that really has been very supportive of this idea of covering up. If you actually look at the science, it appears to be a bit misguided in terms of, you know, what people think. Things aren't always what they seem. In fact, there's been some recent stuff, for example, looking in the American Navy, people working bare-skinned outside as sailors and people working in the bowels of the ship. And they've found that melanoma, which is the concern, is much higher than the people working in the bowel of the ship and the people outside getting the sun exposure. So yes, you don't want to get sunburned, but to completely obstruct sun exposure, I don't think that the recent science is supporting that at all. But yes, many people in our culture do not get enough vitamin D. What I do with patients is I actually do a level, so I get some idea of where their vitamin D should be. And the healthy level, people will often talk in the recent literature about 120 to 200 nanomoles per liter. The average we found in Edmonton was 67, okay, with some people down in the teens. So what we found in our study, if the average person, everybody in our study, took 2,000 units of vitamin D3 every day, most people would have a significant bump up and many of them would be in an optimal range. So that's the minimum that I recommend to people. The only people that we found, one person was in the toxic range where the vitamin D level was way too high, and that was somebody who owned a tanning studio who was getting the frequencies in the tanning studio that was manufacturing, and that's what was putting her over the limit. But there's been studies now where people have taken 10,000 units a day for 6 months, and still none of them were in the toxic range. So 2,000 would be the minimum that I would recommend that people would take. And from there, I actually test people's blood for something called 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which gives us an indication of the level in the body. And then I adjust, because some people need more than others. Okay? Thank you, ma'am.
I have another question.
Sure, go ahead.
The cleansing. I mean, I have never done this, but I know you can go to health food stores and buy cleansing. Do you recommend something like that?
Okay. I wish that it was that easy. Right? I really wish that it was that easy. Each of these compounds has its own behavior. And some, bind and are excreted in the kidneys. Some are what are called lipophilic, and they stick to fat. There's a function in a body called the enterohepatic circulation, where the body recycles and reabsorbs nutrients. Some of these compounds get into that, and so you can't excrete them because they continue to get reabsorbed. Each of the compounds behaves differently. You need to know what you're dealing with and to intervene. For example, that gentleman with the lead, we used a compound that mobilizes lead out of the tissues and then binds it and removes it. The whole area of detoxification is a new science. I wish that this cleanse stuff was the answer to removing everything. Most of the people that I see have tried so many different kinds of cleanses. So the process of detoxification, and that would be another lecture. And let me say, if people are interested, I do have lectures at my office where we discuss all these things. And if you're interested, you could call my office if you want to learn more. Okay? But the whole area of detoxification it's a big area, and different kinds of interventions are used to get out different kinds of chemicals. Okay?
Please.
General practitioners and family physicians, are they knowledgeable about the baseline tests that need to be done to assess these deficiencies? If I went into my family physician and said I want to.
Are family physicians knowledgeable about the basic tests that Dr. Jenness uses?
You know, most of the family physicians I know are wonderful people who really care and want to do the best that they can. The reality is that most of them, though, have a difficult time because they often don't know what's causing a lot of the problems that they're seeing day in and day out in their offices. Unfortunately, this information has not been taught in medical school, and there isn't any facility yet for postgraduate education in this area, in this country. There are some in the United States, and so most physicians are not aware of this area at all and do not have the training yet. I get my referrals from family physicians. Oh, but I know also from specialists. I mean, I get referrals from internists, from all kinds of different people, from physicians. Yes?
Is there being any research to test whether the various very popular radiology diagnostic menu might interfere with the ability to absorb nutrition?
Okay.
MRIs or x-rays or
okay.
Whatever else.
I'm not aware of any research to that effect specifically, but I will tell you, if we look at what we are made of, we're chemical beings, right? If you take apart our bodies, we're chemical machines. But what are chemicals made up? Our nutrients are molecules that are made up of things called atoms. And atoms, when you break them up, have these things, essentially, our body is what's called, it's an electromagnetic machine, an electrochemical machine, in the sense that when you look at what our body is at a very fundamental level, you know, we're a bunch of molecules that come together, but those molecules are made up of atoms, which are made up of electrical particles like protons and neutrons and electrons, the substance of energy. When a person goes in to get a cardiogram, what's it measuring? It's measuring electrical transmission. When they do electroencephalograms, they're measuring electricity in the brain. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that not only is there concern about chemical toxicity, there is now increasing concern about energy and electrical toxicities. That what's being found, like, how does that sun make vitamin D? It releases an electrical frequency. That electrical frequency is interacting on the cholesterol to manufacture the vitamin D. So we depend on electrical frequencies for our body to function. But now we have all kinds of man-made or anthropogenic electrical frequencies coming from all over the place. And they're sending us signals that our body wasn't designed, thank you, it wasn't designed to deal with, right? And so This is a new area. That not only do we have an area of chemical toxicity, we now have exploding electrical things. So what has been found with regards to some of the radiological interventions is that some of them, not all of them, but some of them are emitting a lot of electromagnetic and electrical issues that can affect the DNA functioning. And so there is a lot more concern about how many CAT scans should we do? Should we be doing this CAT scan routinely on this child? Because what's it going to do to the DNA? So there is lots of research going on there, but not so much that I know of with regards to absorptive things. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of drugs. Don't you think that we're up against a real foe there in trying to approach medicine the way you want to approach it?
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, that's a really big area that we could talk about at length, and there's been much written about it. And as you say, you know, dead people and healthy people don't make money, right? You know, so people getting sick as early as they can for as long as period of time will generate money for some kinds of industry. So, yes, that has been expressed. And I will tell you that it's discussed at length in the medical literature. And one of the most notable publications was by a lady named Marcia Angel, A-N-G-E-L-L, and I encourage you to look her up if you're interested in this area. And she wrote a book. This lady was the editor for the New England Journal of Medicine, which some people believe is the leading medical journal in the world. Okay, and she was the editor there. And so after her time there, and I don't know her, but I understand that she had some challenges and looked into this area. She discusses what's really going on and what's driving most of the medical education, how things are getting into the medical literature. And she definitely is of the perspective that there are certain aspects of certain components of industry that are involved in medical education, that are involved at length with regards to medical research, that are involved in publications and journals, that are having a profound influence on the end users, that is a definite challenge. I absolutely agree. But I want to reemphasize, most of my colleagues are people who are doing their absolute best with what they have, right? And I believe that if more of them were introduced to an approach that is, this is in the science, it's in the research, it's all there, that I hope that more of them will have an opportunity to learn about this area and to begin to apply it with their patients. Thank you so much.
You want to say anything more about that, Marcus?
No. You know, how are we going to fight that? That's not really a question, is
yeah.
It? Comment on what Marcus was.
There is another fellow, and I think his name is Moynihan, and he's written a lot in the British Medical Journal. And he's written an article, for example, Who Pays for the Pizza? Because one of the things that happens is that often we have medical education events where pizza may be brought in for the medical students, right? So what you begin to find is that a lot of the postgraduate medical education, a lot of stuff that's going on, is very heavily influenced by industry. So I agree, it's a challenge. But I think the first step is for people to become educated that this problem is going on and that they can be given hope that there is stuff that we can do, and hopefully more and more doctors will begin to be apprised of this information. Thanks for your comments.
Please.
What do you think about chiropractic?
Okay. Well, let me just say, in terms of what do I think about chiropractors, I know some chiropractors because I have a number of them as patients. And so I've had the opportunity to...
Chiropractor, heal yourself.
It's very interesting. I would say that there is a real spectrum and that many of the chiropractors are doing and educating their patients about this. Many of them have begun to learn about nutrition and deficiencies and are addressing that. And many are beginning into the toxicity area as well. I will tell you that I've had the privilege of speaking at a naturopathic conference a couple of years ago that they run every couple of years, where naturopaths came from all over the place. And many of them and many of the chiropractors are more apprised of this information than primary care physicians, right? And so I'm very supportive of anybody that helps and heals people by taking this approach.
Well, how can you find out if you want
to use it? I wonder if you would have this in your repertoire of statistics, any sense of the rough proportion of research money that goes on preventative public health as opposed to curative health?
Okay. In terms of research money, well, then you have to ask, where is research money coming from? And who's funding it, right? So I would say that a huge, like most of the clinical research now is funded by industry. Like most clinical research is funded by industry. And if you look, like I one time reviewed a paper that was looking at the percentage of medical articles that deal with prevention and cause of illness compared to those that are dealing with intervention and treatment, and almost all are dealing with intervention as opposed to cause. And that's because the funding is coming from industry, and it's not necessarily that it's benevolent funding. I mean, they're trying to fund what they're doing. So I can't give you exact numbers, but most clinical research is related to interventional therapies. But the basic science research, which is often funded by public interest, there's all kinds of stuff going on. The problem is that there's this disconnect between the research world and the clinical world. Like, I'm very privileged because I spend half my time doing clinical medicine and the other half I do research. So I have contact with researchers throughout the world, but I'm also seeing people, so I get the privilege of taking the research and applying it. But most people do not have that luxury. Most people are doing their basic science, and they're not dealing with patients then. So they can find all this stuff in the laboratory. And for example, in Alberta right now, there's all kinds of testing where they're looking at cells and putting toxicants in to see what they do. But that's all these basic scientists, and that is funded by the public interest. But that's not being applied to the clinicians. So, I mean, in terms of what needs to be done, we need an amalgamation of these people. We need education of the clinicians. But at the moment, we don't have any facility in Canada to do that. Because most of the education is for physicians who are out there is often held in fancy restaurants in town, supported by industry and things like that, right? So we have a ways to go. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one of the things I'm curious about particularly is you would think that the provincial health administrators would be at the kind of point that we have health ministries and the health boards.
Well, you know, that's an important question because that's where the rubber meets the road, ultimately, with regards to our system. But there are challenges there. I had the privilege a couple of months ago in Kananaskis to give a talk to the Alberta Toxicology Society, and a number of the people from the Department of Public Health, including the head officer of health and some of his people came, and it was a wonderful meeting, and you know, we had the opportunity to talk about, you know, working together and that, and so that was very exciting. But the practical aspects, as one of the fellows directly told me, he said, science is only one of the determinants of why political decisions are made. There's all kinds of things that go on. There's politics, there's ideology, there's what the public is willing to do, what's practical. He said science is only one component of that. And if you look historically, and I'll give one example, because that's the history of ulcer disease. When I was a medical student, I was taught that ulcers, right, were caused by having too much stress and a dominant mother, right? And so when I heard that, I could feel the pain, right? I was in medical school and it was stressful and I had a mother who was pretty dominant, and so I thought, man, I'm sitting duck. But so that was the belief at that time. But in 1983, there were a couple of guys in Australia, Warren and Marshall, who found
That wasn't the case, that it was related to this bacteria that was subsequently called Helicobacter pylori, or H. pylori, right? So these guys wrote a paper with their data, and they tried to get into the medical literature, and they couldn't get in. They had a hard time. In 83, they finally spoke at an international gastroenterology meeting, and they presented their data to the world, right? And they were laughed at and mocked. And Barry Marshall had a hard time. There was no criticism of the science, but they were just sort of discarded. He was upset by this. He took some H. pylori himself, gave himself an ulcer, and treated it to get rid of the bacteria, and was healed, hoping that this would make a difference. No. They did get into the literature in 1984 in The Lancet, but nothing happened. Okay? And as I was training to be a specialist, I saw people doing all kinds of surgical procedures trying to deal with ulcers, right? Even though this was now in literature, right? Now, it was in 1997, I believe, that the Center for Disease Control, because of some public pressure, okay, realized that most doctors still had not adopted this information. And so they went on this widespread campaign blitz to get doctors to learn about that. And in 2004, those guys won the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Okay? So you see that the translation of knowledge in medicine from the lab to the clinic, it has always taken this period of time. And you might say, well, we live in the information age now, so hopefully things can be facilitated a little bit quickly. But we're just at the beginning of this continuum. And so it's meetings like this that push that continuum along, and that's why it's important to discuss this. But I used to have black hair, as what was in my picture here, because I used to get so frustrated about, you know, can't you see it? But then I read a quote by Augustine in the 4th century, who was struggling with these kind of issues of belief. And essentially, he said that people will reject the truth in favor of what they love instead of truth, right? And part of what they love is what they're used to and what they do every day, right? So for somebody to come along and say, what you're doing should be completely revamped and what you've been doing for so long isn't the right way to go, that's hard for people, and they're not automatically just going to embrace it. And so there are challenges, and I've come to peace with the fact that I don't know if we're going to be really quick with adopting this. I hope so, but history shows that it takes time. Thank you.
Thanks so much, and we're going to have to pull this to an end, I think. I do want to say that you do realize the connection here. Martin Luther, you're in one of his churches, was an Augustinian. So, the quoting of Augustine is essentially it. We'll end with your question.
You had mentioned that the Canadian government, and if they follow through on that, that's likely to get a better reaction.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm not aware that it was just sparked by that. There has been research that's been going on in this area now for a number of years. I had the privilege of a few years ago of reviewing a bunch of grant applications. I went to Ottawa, and we were looking for grants for basic science. And I was amazed at how many studies and how are focusing on the impact of exposures on health. So I'm not aware initially what sparked it, but there is now research going on all over the world. So there are many journals that are flooded with this information. The sad reality, though, is it has not made its way into the clinical world just yet.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.